We know from bones found in ancient middens that the herring shoals of the North Atlantic have provided humans in its coastal regions with a vital food source for at least 2,000 years. For people in places where cultivation of food was limited, this bounty of the ocean was, for hundreds of generations, essential to survival. Herring, both fresh and cured, was central to our Hebridean diet until stocks were depleted by overfishing with modern trawlers in the latter decades of the 20th century. Herring spawn in very specific breeding grounds in the coastal waters of the ocean, where one female can lay up to 30,000 eggs. Once the eggs have developed into young fish, they move in shoals to the vast areas of Fiarsochuain, the grass of the ocean, where they feed on plankton. For centuries they were so plentiful that at times of the season they practically came ashore themselves. So it's not surprising that they should become known in Scotland as the Silver Darlings. For not only are they creatures of shimmering beauty, they also contain all the ingredients necessary for human health and vitality. And for this reason, a huge industry developed over the centuries around the coasts and islands. There are two types of herring in the North Atlantic. One which spawns in spring around Iceland, Norway and the Hebrides, and once mature, these shoals were fished around the northern and western areas of Scotland. The shoals of autumn spawning herring are found only in the North Sea, and these were fished off the east coast of Scotland and England. As far as is known, these two types of herring never meet, and so the seasons and locations of the industry were dictated by the movement of the various shoals at different times of the year. For the herring fishermen, knowledge of the currents of Hjørnetua, the North Atlantic drift, which runs past the Norwegian coast and then around the north of Scotland and through the North Sea, was an essential skill required to locate the shoals. The curing industry developed as a way to provide year-round food from these huge seasonal bounties. In earlier centuries, this was done aboard ship, where the herring were roughly gutted and split with the fingers, and packed in barrels of brine. In 1815, an act was passed in Britain which stated that a knife must be used for gutting. And by this time, Britain supplied the enormous demand for cured herring to Russia, Northern Europe and North America. The industry had developed to the extent that catches were brought ashore and curing companies employed coopers to make wooden barrels and girls and women to grade, gut and pack the herring in brine. It was essential to process the herring as soon as possible after catching, and so ports, great and small, along the east coast of Britain and the northern and western isles of Scotland had curing facilities. Such was demand that by the mid-19th century, herring stations were built in any suitable locations. For example, in the Outer Hebrides, where it took too long for sailing vessels to reach the main port of Stornoway when the shoals were fished further north and south, stations were built at various points along the coast. The station north of Stornoway and the road leading to it from the landing place was built on what is now Mycroft. The coastal road and the outlines of the buildings are now covered in meadow grasses which are grazed by my cattle. But I never forget that this quiet place, which I have the good fortune to own, once rang with the voices of herring girls hard at work curing the catches and, of course, knitting their guernseys while waiting for the next boat to sail into the bay. Local girls and women were employed at the Lewis stations, and in order to deal with the enormous catches, they were joined in Stornoway by girls from the mainland. They came from southeast Scotland and northern England, and so there was from this time a fair degree of interaction between the women of the east coast regions of Britain and the Outer Hebrides. By then, the Scotch cure was famed as being the best of the best, and the herring caught in the Minch, that's the stretch of sea separating the Outer Hebrides from mainland Scotland, was considered to be the greatest delicacy of all and had its own local brands assigned. Every aspect of the industry involved a high degree of hard work and skill, not least for the herring lassies. They were required to work from 6 a.m, sometimes straight through until 2 a.m. the following morning. Because of the need to process the herring as soon as it came ashore, the girls were excluded from the factory acts which gave workers protection from unreasonable working hours. They worked in crews of three. Two girls gutted and graded the herring by size and weight, and the third packed them in barrels of brine. They were expected to grade and process 40 herring per minute. Stornoway herring came in 7 grades. Madge, the largest top grade, which was filleted, packed and bound for North America. Then there were large fool, fool, matty fool, matty, spent and torn belly. It was crucial to the entire industry that the herring were correctly graded and packed. So much so that a curer may as well have taken the money he paid the girls and thrown it in the sea rather than hire girls who couldn't grade accurately in the blink of an eye. There were generally just 4 grades on the east coast of Britain. Fool, matties and small matties, which was easier to grade, but nevertheless, gutting, grading and packing at a rate of 40 per minute took skill, dexterity and an ability to concentrate for many hours. Unfortunately, this was not reflected in their pay. And looking at the job from a current perspective, you may wonder why any girl would ever want to undertake such a brutal and disagreeable task for any money. I consider myself very fortunate to have had 3 aunts who were herring girls in their youth. My mother's older sister, Ishbab, my father's sister, Alexandrina, known as Shonak from childhood, and my uncle Donald's wife, Katrina. They all travelled to the Northern Isles and along the east coast of Britain as members of herring crews during the 1920s and 30s. Listening to their first-hand experiences gave me a very different perspective and an altogether better understanding of the life of a herring girl. They all agreed that the work was very hard, the living conditions were often very crude, and they were poorly paid at piecework rates. That is, each crew received a small sum per barrel processed, which amounted to a few pennies when split between them. But in spite of what seemed to me to be appalling work and conditions, they invariably recalled their time as Clonie and Askatan with great affection. I became interested in their youthful adventures through my fascination with their Guernsey knitting, and they were always happy to indulge me by recounting their lives at that time. Girls from Lewis were renowned for their skill, reliability and work ethic, and so they were readily employed, not only by local curing companies, but also by mainland curers who sent their agents to the island to visit door to door in search of crews. They were always hired in crews of 3 girls, 2 gutters and a packer. And any new girl enlisting was generally nominated by girls already experienced who could vouch for her. Once the crew was signed up with the agent, each girl received erlas, which literally translates as the earnest penny. This was an advance of 10 shillings, and it sealed their contract with the curer for the season. The first season began in Stornoway on the 10th of May, and although my aunties all lived within 10 miles of the port, at that time transport was limited and slow, so the first thing they had to do was pack their kists with everything they needed for the season. First on the list was their working gear, which consisted of a pair of wellies, an oilskin bibbed apron, and if you were a first-timer, this cost took care of your earnest penny. A bianach, which was a headscarf, and a nanart buie, yellow calico, to bandage up each finger for protection while working. Yarn, needles and a knitting belt were next on the list, along with personal clothing, including Sunday best for church. The curer supplied only the cuttack, the specialised gutting knife. In Stornoway, they generally stayed in lodgings and they were given money by the curer to pay for food and board throughout, but they received pay for their work only at the end of the contract. They enjoyed their time in Stornoway, meeting up with girls from all over the island who shared their Gaelic language and culture. It also meant that they could attend the Gaelic services in the church, and so it was a gentle and familiar start to the seasons. The Minchcot May herring was mainly top-grade madges, and they were filleted, cured and exported to North America. The fishermen, curers, coopers and herring girls all took great pride in their hard work in producing the finest locally branded product. The girls' fingers were never idle, for they took their knitting with them to work. When there were lulls between boats offloading their catch, they immediately unbandaged their fingers and set about knitting as many rounds as they could of their Guernseys. The coopers gave the girls the signal when a boat was coming back into dock with a shout of, "Kialto Horakan," tie up your fingers. They would put their knitting away, and beginning with the little finger, they bandaged up each one in turn, including their thumbs, with their strips of yellow calico, and they got back to work, grading, gutting, and packing the next catch. The season continued on in Stornoway throughout the summer, but being young and adventurous, they were also excited at the prospect of widening their horizons. And if they were hired by mainland curers, they travelled further afield, starting in Shetland in June. So they packed their kists again, adding bedclothes, pots, pans, and eating utensils for life on the herring trail. Any first-timer who survived the journey and the conditions in Shetland was considered to be hardy enough to last through all the seasons anywhere. Sometimes they went by fishing boat, 370 kilometres of rough sea from Stornoway to Lerwick, or by passenger boat across the Minch from Stornoway to Kyle of Lochalsh, then train across the mainland to Aberdeen. Sometimes the curers hired the whole train as hundreds of Lewis girls travelled at the same time. And then yet another long boat journey from Aberdeen to Lerwick. Whichever way they travelled, it took two exhausting and often seasick days to reach Shetland. They were domiciled in rough wooden huts on the shoreline, which required extensive cleaning before they considered them habitable. And they had to set about this task immediately on arrival, as they began working at 6 a.m. the next morning. But this did not diminish their enthusiasm one jot, and though they were crammed in with sometimes three or four crews to a hut, they were all in it together, and their high-spirited camaraderie overcame all obstacles and inconveniences, including solving the problem of young men who were tempted to peer through the many gaps between the wooden boarding of their huts. My very proper Aunt Ishbel said she would deploy her 16-inch long, double-pointed steel needle without hesitation in order to preserve her modesty. Though she did assure me that the young men were forewarned, and as far as I was told, no one-eyed lads roamed the braes of Shetland. Many of the girls, my aunties included, had fathers or brothers, or both, who were working the same herring route for the season, and so the Gaelic-speaking girls of Lewis, as they were generally known, had familiar family as well as friends around them, wherever they were posted. But my aunts also spoke with great affection of the many friends they made along the way, both local girls and those like themselves who had travelled from different places. After Shetland, they moved along a litany of ports and stations along the east coast of Scotland, and in each place that thread of friendship was greatly enhanced by the activity they all enjoyed at every spare moment they had, knitting Guernseys. I think every knitter can identify with this. There is an eternal pleasure in sharing and comparing notes. Though the results of their knitting were invariably working garments for their male family members, the joy was in the making, sharing all the different patterns, and the creative ways of working them into their Guernseys sparked every girl's interest, and they gave each other constant encouragement and ideas. Every aspect of their knitting was discussed, but nothing was ever written down, and just exactly as these girls expertly measured and weighed every herring at a glance, so they were able to measure and weigh up a man for a Guernsey, and mentally calculate how many stitches they needed for a perfect fit. My Aunt Ishbel typically referred to the chest measurements in terms of her favoured stitch patterns. A 16er, for example, would mean that her intended pattern would fit around the chest exactly 16 repeats. My Aunt Shonach had a particularly strong creative urge and phenomenal energy, which was just as well as she was the only girl in the family and had to knit for her five brothers, my father Thomas included. She told me that no matter how late they were in finishing work, once she had set a new pattern, her itching fingers would wake her up at 4 a.m. and she would rise and get a couple of hours of knitting in before the working day started. I remember her telling me, "I wouldn't have slept anyway for wanting to know how the pattern would turn out." I can certainly identify with that. So it was a very special pleasure for me to see her lovely great-granddaughter Beth, who bears her more than a passing resemblance, photographed wearing a couple of my own Guernseys. The Scottish East Coast season ended in August, and the girls and fishermen came home in time to help the family with the harvest. In October, they all set off again for the next season, this time to the ports of Great Yarmouth and Lowestoft in East Anglia. When this season ended on the 1st of December, they were finally paid. My aunts loved Great Yarmouth. The shops were splendid, filled with desirable items, and for once in their lives they had some money to spend. They treated themselves to some new fashionable clothes and went to have their photographs taken wearing them at a professional photographer's studio. Sometimes they did this with friends or family, and you can see a typical photo of my Aunt Ishba. Note her lovely shiny new 30s style Mary Janes, with her brother Donald wearing his Sunday best Guernsey. They spent most of their money on buying luxury items for the home, the kinds of things they couldn't buy so easily in Stornoway, such as some special table linen, fabric for new curtains, and maybe some fine crockery for entertaining special guests, such as the minister who may visit. The must-haves, which would have been unthinkable to return without, were a large fruit cake. This was special, as the ingredients simply weren't available to them at home. A large pot of jam and a bottle of sherry. Also of paramount importance was a large bag of sweeties for the children of the village. Coming home to the village at the end of the season was exciting for everyone, better than Christmas, and the girls were justifiably proud to return and share the rewards of their hard labour with everyone. On arrival in Stornoway, they caught the bus home, and once the driver reached the village, he slowed right down so that the children who lined the road would catch the sweeties the girls threw out for them. Once inside, the kists were opened, table linen spread, neighbours invited in, and everyone toasted their good fortune with a homemade barley scone and jam, a slice of cake, and a glass of sherry, while the girls regaled them with tales of their adventures. As one old Stornoway cooper said, "Our girls worked hard for their money." My aunts agreed with that statement, and listening to their happy recollections, beautifully reflected in their smiling faces, I understood completely when they went on to say, "We also had the time of our lives." The Gaelic-speaking Hebridean girls were famed far and wide, not only for their reliability and skill, but also for their fastidious appearance, their high moral values, and their exuberant joy of life. There are numerous testimonies on record which give a strong sense of the high regard in which they were held, from those that ran lodging houses where they stayed, to the nurses at the first aid dressing stations, and the ministers of the churches they attended. One testimony in particular conjures up a beautiful image. This is from a woman whose family rented them lodging in their house in Wick in northern Scotland when she was a child. The women would sit on the braes knitting whilst they waited for the boats to come in, dressed immaculately, although in oilskins and Baltic boots, as if they were ready for a church service. As one passed through Lower Pulteney in Wick, one could hear them singing the lovely Gaelic songs as they worked at the herring. And another testimony, this time from Nurse Cameron at the first aid station in Lowestoft, East Anglia, at the southernmost point of the trail in 1921. It was a joy to visit the girls, for they were always so pleased to see their minister and other workers. The Sabbath and Monday Gaelic meetings were a fine sight, and to know and see how much their religion means to our West Coast girls must be a help and an inspiration to those who work among them. We have good reason to be proud of our Clanian Askathan. They were among our very finest Hebridean ambassadors, and so it's fitting that they're honoured with beautiful sculptures at Stornoway Harbour. My personal contribution to their memory was to ensure that the masterful workmanship of Guernsey knitting would not be lost for knitters of the future. They were delighted that I created Guernsey designs with full instructions for knitters today, and astonished that I travelled to North America, as far as their cured matche herring, to teach knitters how to make Guernseys. So it was a very special moment for me to present my aunties with a copy of my book Fisherman's Sweaters and to see which ones they liked best. They loved my Eriskay, particularly the star I had designed, which was an entirely new idea for a Guernsey pattern, and they also loved the large and elaborate anchor. But the big hit for them was my Cape Cod. They loved its intricate femininity, and the idea of shells as pattern imagery. Shonach would have been up all night knitting that one. I thought they would consider the notion of patterned underarm gussets to be frivolous, And though they were amused by the idea of working a pattern where it could only be seen if you were idle with your hands, they understood the fun of creating patterns to fit spaces, and I have no doubt that had they not always been so busy with their hands, they could have weighed and measured that space for a pattern with deadly accuracy.